order with a firm voice. Move in quick time until within 100 yards of the fort, then double quick and charge. His men shouted a war cry and rose to their feet as Shaw turned, drew his sword, and cried, "Forward!" Many white soldiers in the other 13 regiments that had assembled for the attack, as well as some northern journalists standing off on a sand dune, cheered with respect as the black men led the way. As darkness fell, and Shaw and the first members of the unit came close to the fort's guns, Confederates opened a horrifyingly destructive fire. Men screamed, spun, and fell dead and wounded all around into potholes caused by earlier artillery fire, and into the seawater of a moat immediately beneath the parapet. Somehow Shaw and some men trailing him, including Lewis Douglas, survivors remembered hearing his booming voice urging his fellows on, clambered up onto the parapet. Men saw Shaw wildly waving his sword and exhorting them on. He was hit as he leaped into the fort. Nearly half the regiment made it into the fort, fought hand to hand with Confederates, stabbing and smashing one another with rifle butts and bayonets. The 54th held the fort's southeast salient for a short, thrilling time, before being driven out and back into the darkness and carnage of the beach and ocean waves. It was all over in a little more than one frightful hour. Our men fell like grass before a sickle, one surviving officer recounted, but they had performed the immortal one gallant rush Douglas had called them to deliver. Of the 600 members of the regiment who stormed across the beach, 272 were officially killed, wounded, or captured among the more than 1,500 Union troops who fell that night. Miraculously, Lewis made it out of the fight alive. Less than 48 hours later, still on Morris Island, he wrote to Amelia with a chastened but remarkable spirit. "Not a man flinched. Men fell all around me. A shell would explode and clear a space 20 feet. Our men would close up again." Shocked but determined, Lewis offered a common sentiment of soldiers down through the ages who had seen the hell of war. "How I got out of that fight, I cannot tell, but I am here. Remember, if I die, I die in a good cause. I wish we had 100,000 colored troops. We would put an end to this war." That same night, Lewis wrote to his parents to assure them he was among the lucky. "I cannot write in full," he reported, still expecting counterattacks and listening to shells fly overhead. "We made the most desperate charge of the war on Fort Wagner," he said, Douglas likely reading the letter aloud to Anna, "losing in killed, wounded, and missing 300 of our men. The splendid 54th is cut to pieces." Lewis reported the desperate camp myth that Shaw was only wounded and a prisoner, and that all other officers except 8 were lost. "I had my sword sheath blown away while on the parapet of the fort. The grape and canister shell swept us down like chaff. Still, our men went on and on, and had we been properly supported, we would have held the fort, but the white troops could not be made to come up." Lewis signed off in a terrible, withering expression of why he had followed his father's call to go to war. "Goodbye to all. If I die tonight, I will not die a coward. Goodbye." The elder Douglas printed the letter in the August Monthly without comment. Sometimes the great man's silence, though frustrating, possessed its own eloquence. The profound heroism of Fort Wagner was best left to an eyewitness, Douglas, the fortunate son still alive in the marshes and blistering heat of Morris Island. Soon Lewis, like multitudes all across the North, would know that Shaw had been thrown with some of his men into a mass grave in the sand in front of Fort Wagner. Shaw became an instantaneous patrician martyr for the cause of black freedom. Over time, in poetry, music, and bronze, he emerged as an iconic symbol of the emancipationist memory of the Civil War. The siege of Charleston would continue for another year and a half. Survival from wounds was only one crisis the men of the 54th and all other black soldiers faced that summer. They now fought, suffered from disease, and died under the weight of brutal discriminations. In June 1863, the War Department added insult to injury in its treatment of black soldiers. To the denial of commissions, it added the policy of unequal pay. White privates were paid $13 per month, while blacks were to receive $10, from which $3 would be deducted to cover the expense of clothing. Such a policy was shabbily justified on the grounds that the Militia Act of 1862 had empowered the president to enlist black troops at a standard of $10. Previous solemn pledges of equality by Secretary of War Stanton, Governor Andrew, and numerous generals and recruiting agents, such as Douglas, were simply disregarded. As black enlistment moved into the border states and the Deep South, resistance to unequal pay swelled. Whole units of black troops began to refuse pay altogether, while it remained unequal. Some regiments, including the 54th Massachusetts, accepted no wages at all well into 1864. This bitter reality caused desperate problems for impoverished black families back home in northern communities and in freedmen's camps. Non-commissioned officers were especially angered when they realized that the highest-ranking black sergeant, such as Lewis Douglas, earned less than a white private. Letters and petitions from outraged black soldiers poured into the offices of Stanton, Lincoln, and state governors, especially Andrew. James Gooding, a corporal in the 54th, wrote an especially eloquent appeal to the president in September. Gooding told Lincoln that he and his comrades had been obedient, patient, and solid as a wall. "Now, Your Excellency," he wrote with the sacrifice at Fort Wagner in mind, "we have done a soldier's duty. Why can't we have a soldier's pay?" Sergeant George E. Stevens, a Philadelphian, became a kind of official spokesman for the men of the 54th in his regular letters to the weekly Anglo-African. In early August 1863, he denounced unequal pay as the Lincoln despotism. Anger erupted into violent confrontations between officers and enlisted men, insubordination, and genuine mutiny in the 54th and many other regiments by early 1864. Indeed, some protests ended in courts-martial in some units and executions by firing squads for refusal to perform duty without equal pay. These direct appeals to the highest power spoke of the anguish of betrayal and deprivation, as well as the spirit of citizenship. The situation caused Douglas deep sadness and discouragement. In a pattern so old and agonizing, history once again giveth profound change while racism waited in the wings and taketh it back. Douglas eventually found the words to express such agony. "It really seems that nothing of justice, liberty, or humanity can come to us except through tears and blood." Prior to the government's enactment of the unequal pay policy, Douglas had steadfastly maintained that blacks should enlist despite the denial of commissions. Although ambivalent, he was ready to reconcile the inequality with the old argument that blacks faced two enemies, Southern slavery and Northern racism. "We shall be fighting a double battle," he said repeatedly, "against slavery at the South and against prejudice and proscription at the North. Blacks should not let one enemy prevent them from thwarting or destroying the other. They should expect annoyance, but let no man hold back on this account. A half loaf is better than no loaf." But by midsummer 1863, the struggle was no longer a mere annoyance, and the wordmaster recruiter knew it. The idea of a double battle formed a constant theme in Douglas's wartime thought. George Stearns employed the same notion, persistently arguing to young volunteers, "You must fight to obtain the right to fight on terms of equality." But for men who bought into the argument initially, the bold-faced, flagrant character of the inequality they faced at the front made it impossible to abide while risking their lives for a vague hope of justice later. Douglas had admitted in April speeches that black enlistment had come about by a tardy backdoor manner, and that his own blood boiled at the discriminations, even as he urged black men to join up. On July 6th in Philadelphia, at a rally where he made a last attempt to reconcile enlistment with discrimination, Douglas tried to chart a pragmatic course, but he found tiptoeing around the inequality issue no longer tenable. Few men came forward from the huge crowd of 5,000 in National Hall. The appalling casualty numbers of the Battle of Gettysburg, fought only 90 miles west of Philadelphia, had reached the audience by the time Douglas addressed them. Only a week later, draft riots broke out in New York City, in which at least a dozen blacks were murdered and many more injured. Douglas was still in Philadelphia, working among black troops at the huge Camp William Penn, when the New York violence began. He managed, with the aid of a friend, probably Odely Ossing, to travel by train through Newark and New York to the Hudson River Railroad and on to Rochester, narrowly escaping rampaging mobs. Douglas had faced many violent mobs before, but these, he recollected, were something more and something worse. They were the fire of the enemy opened in the rear of the loyal army. These were mobs not merely throwing brickbats. They were intent on lynching black people. Perhaps most disheartening of all, the Confederate Secretary of War, James A. Seddon, had ordered the death penalty for black soldiers taken as prisoners, followed by the Confederate Congress's authorization for treating captured blacks and their white officers as insurrectionists, thus subject to death. Thus, 1863 was indeed a year of revolution and counter-revolution. The Union government's lack of response to these inhumane policies angered Douglas even further. Sometime in late July, after the news from Fort Wagner, he penned two editorials in which he attacked Lincoln's silence on the killings of black prisoners and the threats of their enslavement. He now had to square his own son's heroism and that of his comrades, dead and alive, with Confederate and apparently federal disregard for their very humanity. "The slaughter of blacks taken as captives," wrote an outraged Douglas, "seems to affect him, Lincoln, as little as the slaughter of beeves for the use of his army." The editor, recruiter, father, wanted an eye for an eye. One Confederate put to death for every black soldier killed as a prisoner of war. Like most Northern leaders, Lincoln had little stomach for this kind of retaliation, but the appeal did not go unanswered. 3 days after Fort Wagner, the president issued a retaliatory order that contained a one-for-one policy. One rebel soldier put to death for each soldier of the United States executed, and one put to hard labor for every Union soldier sold into slavery. The cruel war had escalated to a new scale of savagery. By August 1st, not yet aware of the retaliatory order, a furious Douglas in protest quit recruiting and weighed his options. In an official letter to Stearns, he declared a duty to his people, especially those he had enlisted, to expose their wrongs and plead their cause. Douglas abruptly switched hats, temporarily ceasing his role as a war propagandist and recruiting agent, while returning to the role of black leader. His faith in national leadership was nearly gone. "When I plead for recruits," he told Stearns, "I want to do it with all my heart, without qualification. I cannot do that now." Douglas atoned for his promises of equal treatment in the army and admitted to helping foster a false estimate of the Union government's generosity. He seemed not only discouraged, but even exhausted and confused. His zigzag on the inequality issue no doubt reflected the strain of constant travel and recruiting before increasingly reluctant audiences. Moreover, the presence of his sons at the war front may have curbed his enthusiasm. In a letter to a white friend, Martha Green, Douglas described his sons as fighting with halters about their necks. Green, whose own son had been wounded in the war, wrote back expressing her sympathy for the orator as a black parent. "The white mothers and fathers think it hard to send our sons to fight, with every assurance of their protection," said Mrs. Green. "How little we know the depth of earnestness it must require in you to send yours." Such depths had been a constant tension now for many months in the Douglas family. Fort Wagner now loomed large in Douglas's conscience, which he made movingly clear to Stearns. "How many 54ths must be cut to pieces, its mutilated prisoners killed, and its living sold into slavery, before Mr. Lincoln shall say, 'Hold, enough'?" Stearns did not allow his most prominent recruiter to step aside easily with such cries in the night. He sent Douglas the news of Lincoln's retaliatory proclamation and urged Douglas to go to Washington and present the black soldiers' grievances directly to the president. On August 9th to 10th, Douglas took the B&O train south through Baltimore to the nation's capital. Although he never left the cars, traveling alone, it marked the first time he had returned to a slave state and to the city from which he had escaped in 1838. Poignant memories surely flowed in his weary mind on the overnight train. As he stepped out in Washington, only a few blocks from the Capitol, the city gave the impression of one large wartime hospital. The streets swarmed with troops and military vehicles, while thousands of escaped slaves trying to forge secure lives without adequate housing and food appeared all around as the well-attired 45-year-old Douglas strode up Pennsylvania Avenue toward the executive mansion. The revolution was both ugly and thrilling. Douglas had no invitation from the White House, but he did have contacts, especially Senator Samuel Pomeroy of Kansas, who had agreed to help. They first went to the War Department, where Douglas and his portly senatorial guide were promptly admitted in the early morning to see Secretary Edwin Stanton. With his wire glasses and his long beard hanging down on his chest, Stanton was all business and no small talk. Politeness was not one of his weaknesses, Douglas recollected of Stanton. His brusqueness seemed to fill the air of the office, as if he might turn his back on me as a bore at any moment. The visitor got right to the point, and Stanton engaged in a full 30-minute discussion about the plight of black soldiers. Douglas instructed Stanton about the Negro character. "Too many people think blacks are either angel or demon," Douglas said, "but they ought not be viewed in extremes. Some are brave and others cowardly, some ambitious and another part quite otherwise." Douglas protested in no uncertain terms the unequal pay and place for black troops, putting the secretary on the defensive to the extent that he confessed full verbal support for equality. Douglas backed off for comedy's sake, saying that blacks should still fight because they had a cause quite independent of pay or place. Before leaving, Stanton surprised Douglas by declaring that he wanted the orator to go to the Mississippi River Valley and join General Lorenzo Thomas as an adjutant in recruiting and organizing black troops. Sufficient papers, an appointment as a commissioned officer, would soon be forthcoming. No smiles and only quick handshakes were necessary as the flattered Douglas, with Pomeroy in tow, exited the War Department. At Stanton's instruction, they next visited Secretary of the Interior John Usher to receive Douglas's pass to go south through Army lines. Usher signed it in a beautiful hand, after which Pomeroy also added his signature boldly just below. The pass read, "Frederick Douglass is known to us as a loyal free man, and is hence entitled to travel unmolested. We trust he will be recognized everywhere as a free man and a gentleman." As the men departed the Interior Department, they had a chance encounter with Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, who also wanted in on the special identity document for the former slave. He too signed his name to the bottom of the letter with the inscription, "Pass this bearer, Frederick Douglass, who is known to be a free man." No one ever wrote Douglas a pass to get out of slavery. Now the government's highest officials were signing on to pronounce this black man free. One wonders if Douglas could hardly contain laughter at the irony of Blair, the nemesis of less than a year ago, who had insultingly tried to enlist Douglas to oversee the administration's colonization schemes, now falling all over himself in a government hallway to endorse the same man to go find former slaves to put in uniform. At times, Douglas's life must have seemed to him like 100 rickety bridges held together with wire made of irony. He could not know for sure if those signatures were sincere, or merely a means to keep him moving through hallways and out of Washington. "Keep the black man running" is an old mantra in America. But Douglas had one more conversation to have, and one more signature to secure. He and Pomeroy walked to the White House and joined the daily line of patronage seekers. The editor gave his card to an attendant and sat down on the stairs expecting a long wait. To his great surprise, Douglas was quickly ushered past the chagrined crowd of white men in front of him, at least one of whom muttered something about a nigger. Time and events would soften and sentimentalize Douglas's memory of this signal moment. I shall never forget my first interview with this great man. In the coming months, Douglas turned a remembrance of the interview into a classic performance. In December 1863, he entertained an audience of prominent abolitionists with a rather flatulent telling of his presidential visit. He spoke jokingly about how he had always been warned about traveling too near to the slave border states. "I can go down there now," said Douglas, garnering applause. "I have been down there to see the president." He knew his listeners could not resist hearing how a president received a black man at the White House. As though he were converting this deeply symbolic historic moment into instant folklore, Douglas made his audience laugh as well as feel lumps in their throats. The meeting was just as you have seen one gentleman receive another, with a hand and a voice well balanced between a kind of cordiality and a respectful reserve. I tell you, I felt big there. Big, indeed. In reality, Douglas was awed by Lincoln, but the story had only begun. A lifetime of making himself into a character now blossomed because Douglas had found the ultimate counterpart actor, at least in the power the other character represented. Douglas had finally made it to the inner sanctum of American power, to the headquarters where this apocalyptic war was conducted, to the head man, as he put it, of a great nation. Here was the authority he had spent so much energy and time attacking and trying to influence. He relished telling the tale of getting to him, of elbowing his way up the stairway past all the angry white office seekers, as the only dark spot among them. Douglas had his audience gasping with laughter as he related, with a lightness of being, the scene in the messy office full of papers and hustling aides. The president was sitting in his usual position, with his feet in different parts of the room, taking it easy. Douglas then shouted to a reporter, milking laughs into a roar, "Don't put this down, I pray you. I am going down there again tomorrow." Then Douglas reached the punchline of the tale. As the two men approached, the president began to rise, and he continued rising until he stood over me, Douglas declared while shrinking under the imaginary hulking Lincoln. The two shook hands firmly as Lincoln uttered, "Mr. Douglas, I know you. I have read about you, and Mr. Seward has told me about you." With the visitor feeling at ease, the two men got down to business, with Lincoln listening intently as Douglas entered his grievances. Douglas's later recollections of this meeting, though romanticized and vainglorious, square with his immediate report. Only 2 days after the visit, he told Stearns that he fully understood why Lincoln was called Honest Abraham, and that he had never seen a more transparent countenance. Douglas thanked the president for his retaliatory order, while also pushing for equal pay and commissions. Lincoln had responded frankly to vindicate his policy respecting the whole slavery question, and especially that in reference to employing colored troops. The chief executive did not equivocate and firmly defended himself against the charge of tardiness, hesitation, and vacillation, of which Douglas had personally accused him. Douglas quoted Lincoln, "I think the charge cannot be sustained. No man can say that having once taken the position, I have contradicted it or retreated from it." Lincoln argued that with the retaliatory order, as with emancipation itself, he always had to weigh public popular prejudice first, and that his paramount job was the necessary preparation of the public mind for such enactment. Lincoln further told Douglas that the bitter inequality black troops faced was a necessary concession for them to serve at all. These were not the sentiments Douglas had hoped to hear. He swallowed the painful reminder that policy had been the handmaiden of racism, but he told Stearns that he found Lincoln's decency and forthrightness gratifying, and that he left the meeting feeling assured that the melancholy man in charge would stand firm, that slavery would not survive the war, and that the country would survive both slavery and the war. In this stunning encounter, Douglas had been disarmed to an extent by his host's unpretentiousness and received a political education of a kind. Lincoln, too, had perhaps learned something of how a black leader felt about the war for their future and the inhumanities they endured to fight it. The president might also have sensed for future reference how this brilliant radical pragmatist sitting with him that morning might be useful to the nation's survival. It is equally possible that the burdened and wily Lincoln could have played Douglas to get rid of an immediate problem. As Lincoln lounged in his chair in familiar surroundings, though, amid the terrible anxiety of the war, the son of an Indiana dirt farmer surely understood in some fleeting moment that he had helped the most famous former slave and free black man in America feel big in the president's mansion. Would that Lincoln had lived to tell of it in his own performative way in a memoir. As he was leaving, Douglas told Lincoln of Stanton's invitation for him to go south as a recruiter and showed his pass. Lincoln read the document with the signatures, turned it in his hand, and wrote on its side, "I concur, A. Lincoln, August 10th, 1863. Douglas ended his flying visit, as he called it, and took the afternoon train out of Washington. He left, believing he had a promise of a commission in the U.S. Army from Stanton, who may have been more adept at getting the abolitionist visitor out of his office than at sincerity. With a new excitement, Douglas returned to Rochester and quickly decided to cease publication of his newspaper, rushing a final valedictory issue into print. Ending the paper that had been a center to his life for 16 years involved emotions he could hardly express. His new prospect of going south, he thought with an officer's rank, felt daunting. His decision was not dictated by love of change or adventure. "My stability is quite equal to that of most men. My paper ends its existence in the same room on the same street where it began. Along with his ubiquitous oratory and his autobiographical writings, editor was the only professional vocation he had ever known." He did hear from Stanton, receiving orders to report to General Thomas in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Douglas's transportation would come at government expense, but to his great disappointment, the commission never arrived. Apparently Stanton, and perhaps Lincoln as well, had second thoughts about commissioning a black man. On August 14th, Douglas wrote to the War Department, inquiring as to the conditions of his service. The reply 1 week later discussed only his remuneration and again instructed him to report to Mississippi, where he would be expected to exercise influence among the freedmen. So long practiced at weathering or resisting racial slights, this was one he could not abide. Without the commission, Douglas did not go south. Why did he not budge from Rochester without the commission? And further, why had he not already enlisted in active service? Certainly his recruiting campaign, paid for by government and private funds, Stearns, had been a form of service. Earlier in the year, the Ohio black abolitionist H. Ford Douglas, who had also lived in Canada and Illinois and supported Delaney's plans for immigration, wrote to Douglas urging him to take the symbolic lead and enlist in the army. H. Ford Douglas himself had enlisted in an Illinois regiment, and now he called on the famous orator to finish the crowning work of your life. You are the one of all others. Douglas disagreed with his colleague, who was a mixed-race former fugitive slave from Virginia, self-educated and 13 years younger. Douglas understood the call to put down the quill and take up the sword, he said, but we have no very high opinion of our fighting qualities, and have no military knowledge, but we suppose we could fight if cornered. He had fought when cornered many times, but he was no warrior. With voice and pen, the writer-orator preferred to recruit younger men. In Life and Times, Douglas's explanation of why he did not go to Mississippi without the commission is lame. "I knew too much of camp life and the value of shoulder straps in the army to go into the service without some visible mark of my rank." Yet this is exactly what he had argued thousands of younger blacks, including his sons, to do. His reaction to Stanton's initial offer was no doubt sincere. He did end his beloved Douglas's Monthly. but he may also have simply been highly stressed and confused about his priorities. As late as August 19th, Douglas told a correspondent of his disappointment that no commission had arrived. "I shall obey, however, hoping that all will be well in the end." Douglas may have felt as much flattered by his Washington interviews and the invitation to a commission as he was ever inspired about venturing into the Mississippi River Valley. Before the end of the month, Douglas decided not to obey his orders from the War Department. His best reasons were likely deeply personal. Two sons were in the daily peril of war, and Frederick Jr. was already in Mississippi laboring as a recruiter. He would soon be back in Rochester, ill and convalescing. Douglas had to be a father as well as the Union war effort's fiercest propagandist. Those dual, contradictory roles now collided and forced a reckoning. He often referred to his sons that summer with swelling pride, as if they were his surrogates at war. They must have felt that way, too. He corresponded with them often, sending them money and loving encouragement. In July 1863, a correspondent to the Anglo-African called him to task for sending his sons to a war he would not fight himself. Douglas bristled and called the charge malicious. He again disclaimed any ability as a soldier. "When came this confidence in me as a warrior? When have I been heard as a military man?" He felt no compulsion to enlist until his fellow blacks found someone to fill my place at the North. Irked by the claim that he let his sons do his fighting for him, he simply replied, "I am proud to refer to my two sons." But the sons were in dire need of help. Charles was still in Boston in August and September, alternately sick or complaining bitterly of hunger, ill-treatment, and the general anguish of army life. Under a regimen of working in an army hospital, he craved an officer's praise for his labors, but also alarmed his parents by noting that he was losing weight. "I fell away like a skeleton." A lonely Charles promised that he never brought any disgrace upon the family, but he insisted that the remnants of the 54th were treated worse than dogs since the full regiment had deployed to the South. He had heard news that Lewis was highly spoken of and might get a commission, but also that he had fallen sick on Morris Island. By December, Charles was embroiled in a lawsuit against someone he alleged had mistreated him. Lewis had been more badly injured at Fort Wagner than he had initially let on. On August 15th, he wrote to Amelia complaining of terrible headaches. "As artillery shells were flying and whizzing in our front, Lewis moved to the Sick and Wounded Hospital No. 6 in Beaufort, directed by the irrepressible Harriet Tubman." By August 27th, he reported that he felt a little better, but writing from a water-soaked tent, he was still ill. As Union artillery sustained a daily bombardment of Forts Wagner and Gregg on the Marshy Island and Sumter in the harbor, the 54th were part of the troops who continued to dig ditches and trenches up the beach, right to the face of Wagner. Again, Lewis reflected on death with austere fatalism. "Death must be dealt out and must be received. Some of us will live to see rebellion crushed, and some of us will die crushing it. Either is glorious." On September 6th to 7th, Fort Wagner was finally evacuated after weeks of bombardment and much loss of life on both sides. Given his bad health, Lewis likely was not part of the victorious group that occupied the huge heap of destruction. Henry Gooding, of the 54th, was appalled by what he found. "The smell in Wagner was sickening. Dead men and mules are profuse, some exposed to the rays of the sun, and others being half buried by earth thrown over them by our shot and shell during the bombardment." The men of the 54th had now seen many weeks of the horror and the refuse of mangled humanity that war wrought. George Stevens also reported the glorious fall of Fort Wagner and noted that some furloughs had been granted for the first time for the 54th. Among those heading north on a steamer by the second week of September was Lewis Douglas, who had become very sick. While Lewis suffered at an army hospital in New York in September and early October, His father arranged for his dear friend and doctor, James McCune Smith, to examine him. Whether due to battle wounds or general camp exposure, Smith diagnosed Lewis on October 6th with gangrene of left half of scrotum, and for the time being, unfit for service. With Odile Ossing possibly at his side, Douglas hurried to New York, and as he reported to Garrett Smith, he spent the last 3 weeks bending over the sick bed of his ailing son. The father was proud that the son's furlough was granted for good conduct in the field. Lewis recovered later at home in Rochester in his mother's care and would be discharged from the army in February 1864. He eventually married Amelia Logan in 1869, but the war-ravaged romantic recruit of spring 1863, who also nurtured a lifetime pride in his service, never conceived children. Other than expressing fierce pride, Douglas never betrayed any of his feelings from those weeks of hovering over Lewis's bedside, nor from any visits to other wounded men in that hospital. Douglas kept his fears, as well as any guilt in his heart, private. Douglas was a reformer, not a soldier. As an adjutant recruiting refugee freedmen from cotton plantations in Mississippi, he may have envisioned himself a fish out of water or stultified under a general's orders since leaving the Garrisonians, yet never operated under anyone else's direction. How could he continue to reach the widest possible audiences and touch the highest levels of power in Washington if he relocated to Vicksburg? Douglas received a great deal of reinforcement for his self-image as black symbol and spokesman. No doubt, if given a voice, Anna would have opposed the move south. Certainly, Odile Ossing did not want the object of her obsessive concern journeying off to the war fronts of Dixie either. Most of all, Douglas heard forcefully from his British friends, especially Julia Crofts, as he also continued to receive their financial support. Crofts vehemently discouraged his plans to give up the paper, and especially pleaded with him not to join the army. Douglas had written earlier in the year about an interest in enlisting if the state of New York would guarantee equal rights. "By everything dear to you, my friend," Crofts responded, "do not take any commission that leads you personally into the fighting ranks. Never go south, or killed you most assuredly will be. You are a marked man." Julia's wise advice may have weighed on him as he rejected the assignment in the south. She had left this ringing plea in his ears: "The pen is ever greater than the sword. The head is greater than the hand. Your work is with your pen and tongue." By December, his dearest English friend wrote of her relief that the dangerous task of recruiting in the South is given up, but she lamented the newspaper and wondered how he would carry on his mission without it. In November, President Lincoln went to the ravaged town of Gettysburg to dedicate a cemetery for the unprecedented numbers of dead on that battlefield. A staggering nearly 6,000 had been killed between July 1st and 3rd on the two sides, with over 27,000 wounded and almost 12,000 missing. Lincoln, too, gave a new speech. He had long worked on or conjured the central themes he would address in his short masterpiece delivered on November 19th. In but three paragraphs, he attempted an explanation of the war. As a superb student of Lincoln's rhetoric, Douglas Wilson has put it, "The president answered a huge and terrible question. What was the war about?" With astonishing succinctness, Lincoln told his countrymen that the old republic had died on that battlefield. It was being buried in all the unfinished graves. Out of the bloodletting, the American people, indeed the nation, could experience a new birth of freedom. Popular government as an idea might yet be saved, human freedom forged in new definitions, and even that most vexing Enlightenment idea of all, equality, launched on a new history. The First Republic was dying before their eyes. At horrible cost, a new one could yet be achieved. That breathtaking metaphor of rebirth, in many versions, had long been Douglas's favorite metaphor as well. He had himself delivered variations of the Gettysburg Address throughout the war, Now, with resounding implications, by the end of that terrible year of 1863, Lincoln and Douglas spoke from virtually the same script, one of them with the elegance and restraint of a statesman, the other the fiery tones of a prophet. One spoke with an eye on legality and public opinion, while also listening to his evolving moral self, the other as though he were the national evangelist. In his annual message of December 8, 1863, Lincoln declared that the policy of emancipation gave to the future a new aspect. This new reckoning might now remake America into the home of freedom disenthralled, regenerated, enlarged. Douglas could not have said it better, but came close. Embarking on a new speaking tour in fall 1863 and winter 1864, he honed one of his greatest speeches. In The Mission of the War, the black leader declared that however long the shadow of death cast over the land, Americans should not forget the moral grandeur of the struggle. The shuddering scale of death in this war had to be rendered sacred, Douglas contended in this signature oration, or the slaughter could not be defended. The mission of this war, Douglas pronounced, is national regeneration. Together, Lincoln and Douglas, rarely in purposeful tandem and against overwhelming odds, had provided the subjunctive and declarative voices of the Second American Revolution. And by the last year of the war, they were nearly the same. Chapter 20. Abolition War, Abolition Peace. The most hopeful fact of the hour is that we are now in a salutatory school, the school of affliction. If sharp and signal retribution, long protracted and overwhelming, can teach a great nation respect for justice, surely we will be taught now and for all time to come. Frederick Douglass, February 1864. In Frederick Douglass's view, during the final year and a half of the Civil War, one America died a violent, necessary death. Out of its ashes, a second, redefined America came into being amid destruction and explosions of hope. At war's end, Douglass could almost fashion himself as one of the unusual founders of this emerging Second American Republic, born in a revolution even bigger than the first. As 1864 dragged on, Douglass contemplated the war's revolutionary and prophetic meaning for himself, his family, his people, and his nation. The issues of Reconstruction also captured his attention. Douglass sought to convince everyone of what he believed. The American nation and history itself had taken a rare, fundamentally moral turn. Douglass took to the lecture circuit with The Mission of the War, his fullest expression of the war's meaning. In Philadelphia on December 4, 1863, at the 30th anniversary meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society, Douglass offered a refutation, in the presence of his old mentor, of William Lloyd Garrison's declaration that this might be the final meeting of the organization, now that emancipation had dawned. Announcing that our work is not done, Douglass warned of the deep racism within Northern society and in the Democratic Party. He especially called for black male suffrage. Casting the argument in humor, Douglass reminded his auditors that the American body politic had never been healthy. He had many times seen ignorance trying to vote alongside a swerving man from the street with a black eye. And as he was long fond of saying, he had seen drunken Pat, fresh from the Emerald Isle, stepping up to the pole, leaning upon the arms of two of his friends, unable to stand. The franchise would protect blacks in the South, Douglass argued to rousing laughter and applause, from the jaws of the wolf. His people ought to be members of Congress, he asserted. You may as well make up your minds that you have got to see something dark down that way. There is no way to get rid of it. I am a candidate already. His Irish jokes notwithstanding, he left the abolitionists cheering as he demanded that they join his plea for an abolition war and an abolition peace. Douglass's new speaking tour, like so many before, took on the character of a traveling crusade. Within 2 days, he was in Washington, D.C., where over consecutive nights, December 7th to 8th, he delivered the mission speech to overflow crowds at the African-American 15th Street Presbyterian Church. More than 1,000 people, according to a journalist, thronged the church, jumping over the fence, some crawling over someone's back, jamming the sanctuary, filling the aisles, and sitting on the floor. With hats and bonnets falling off all around, the glorious conglomeration anticipated the arrival of the African lion of the anti-slavery platform, said the Christian Recorder. Amid shouting and applause, Douglas slowly made his way down the crammed central aisle as the organ played the Star-Spangled Banner. He took the pulpit, told tales of his emotions while passing through Baltimore on his journey, and made his appeal for abolition war to the finish, a struggle of conquest between slavery and liberty. No one went home disappointed, since the following evening an equally packed and raucous crowd gathered to hear Douglas make his appeal for access to political rights, to the ballot box, alongside the drunken Irishman and the ignorant Dutchman. Douglas soared rhetorically, calling on the nation to allow black men to swell the body politic as they helped win the war. The racially mixed audience all seemed pleased, said the correspondent. They had seen the great Douglas. As the celebrity orator held forth at 15th Street Presbyterian with his vision of the apocalyptic revolution underway, some dozen blocks directly to the south, President Lincoln, on that same day of December 8th, issued his annual message to Congress, in which he reflected on how the policy of emancipation had given to the future a new aspect and launched a total revolution of labor throughout the South. Within the same hours, both men, Lincoln with his pen, Douglas with his voice, imagined a nation regenerated through bloodshed on battlefields and the social misery in the streets surrounding them. In the crowd that swarmed around the church where Douglas appeared were many former slaves from the surrounding Virginia and Maryland countryside. Washington had become a massive military base. A series of hospitals functioning in churches, schools, and government buildings, and a massive street-based refugee camp. In 1862-63, a freedmen's exodus had rolled into the capital, with thousands of refugees taking up residence in tar paper shanties and former soldiers' barracks, such as Camp Barker, an old military residence and sometime prison converted into a tent city at Q and 12th Streets, near the current-day Logan Circle. By war's end, the black population of the district swelled to 40,000. Douglas saw and likely visited Camp Barker, since it was only 4 blocks east of the 15th Street Church. Indeed, he made his mission speaking tour in part a fundraising campaign for contraband relief organizations. During his stay in Washington, Douglas visited the burgeoning Freedmen's Village contraband camp on Arlington Heights, across the Potomac River, on the former estate of Robert E. Lee. His fellow slave narrative author and former Rochester neighbor, Harriet Jacobs, worked in that camp and in others around the city. The misery she witnessed there had to be seen to be believed, she wrote. Refugees arrived daily from the war fronts of Virginia, and despite their destitution, as well as the mistreatment many experienced from Union troops, she found these people quick, intelligent, and full of the spirit of freedom. What but the love of freedom could bring these old people thither? Jacobs unforgettably asked. During Douglas's brief visit among the freed people in Arlington, as he strode for the first time on Virginia soil, a small ceremony was arranged at which a group of children sang for him. Only 3 days later, his close Rochester friend Amy Post visited the freedmen's camps in Washington. Post left a detailed description of the Arlington site, met numerous former slaves of the Lee family, and observed at the schoolroom Frederick Douglass's autograph, which was the first intimation that he had visited any of the camps. We do not have Douglass's account of his own emotions, but he did write to friends describing the episode. In January 1864, he wrote to Julia Crofts in England. She felt thrilled to know that Douglas felt so moved by his visit to Washington and Arlington Heights. How I should like to have been an eyewitness of your visiting those dear little children, and to have heard the singing. My eyes would not have been dry, she continued, marveling at Douglas's news of the slaveholder's smokehouse being converted into a schoolhouse for his freed slave children. So eager were some of Douglas's British friends for news of the war and his activities that Julia took his letters out on the circuit to local anti-slavery societies and tried to bolster support and raise money by reading extracts of your letters relative to the contrabands. Moreover, Douglas's voice, in a manner, migrated into Germany in 1864 to the columns of Otely Assing in Morgenblatt. Partly by projecting Douglas's ideas about the war, as well as with her own keen radical observations, Assing told her readers in January that American abolitionists, despite their divisions, represented the spirit of the 19th century and of civilized progress. They represented the vanguard of the present revolution, as Montesquieu, Voltaire, and Rousseau were the vanguard of the French Revolution. By March, she considered black regiments marching south the best representation of a great revolution. In her passionate essays, Assing echoed her hero's mission and emancipation as a world historical event. Close friends wrote to Douglas wondering when your mission would bring the orator to their town. From England by April, the intrepid Julia Crofts sent £33 in contributions to contraband aid, as well as for FD's mission from anti-slavery societies in Edinburgh, Liverpool, Coventry, and Aberdeen. Another old British friend, Mary Carpenter, joined Crofts in scolding Douglas for ceasing the publication of his paper, upon which British abolitionists depended so much for news of the cause. She wondered about the fate of the mission and where their hero traveled. We know you live, she said, to promote that cause, but others ask, what is FD doing now that the paper has given up? Carpenter sent a check for £5 and felt resigned to sympathize affectionately with you in the painfully exciting life you must now be living. Painful and exciting indeed. Sponsored by the Women's Loyal League, an organization advocating a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery, Douglas delivered the mission speech to a packed house at the Cooper Institute in New York on January 13th. He led with his millennial vision of the war, filling the hall with a tone of high moral certainty, and with arguments both shuddering and hopeful. To Douglas, the war in all its destruction was like a terrible, necessary gift from history and from Providence. The South's rebellion was the rapid educator by which the Union leadership moved from slave hunting on behalf of their enemies to now equipping the Negro with a Springfield rifle. Ever the earnest war propagandist, now indeed more than ever, he believed, Douglas minced no words in describing the Confederacy as a solitary and ghastly horror without a parallel in the history of any nation, a political crusade of naked barbarism in its attempt to give slavery an eternal foundation. He drew on Psalm 91 to make clear the character of the enemy. The Confederates and their cause rivaled the earthquake, the whirlwind, and the pestilence that walketh in darkness and wasteth at noonday. Confederates had to be met and slaughtered no matter how long and sanguinary the struggle. The ferocity of Douglas's language knew no limit. Acknowledging that he had been accused of prolonging the war, his angry answer was, "The longer, the better, if it must be so." An audience that may have been a majority of women stood on their feet, waved their hats, and shouted approval. In thus sacralizing the killing of Southern soldiers and of the Confederacy itself, Douglas found the war's meaning. The orator believed he described only stark facts, time and events, and fierce Southern resistance had made the contest an abolition war. Northern Democrats and white Southerners denounced abolition war as the inhumane path to sanguinary race war. Both sides felt something deeply sacred at stake, and no one more than Douglas. Yes, he acknowledged, the war was for Union and for the Constitution, but it must be a wholly new Union and a new Constitution to replace the old one now torn and tattered. The country must not put old wine in new bottles, he argued, nor make new cloth into old garments. Douglas warned that liberal and open-minded people, such as abolitionists themselves, were rarely as unified as the forces of reaction and darkness. But in this historic moment, they had to be. "That old Union," he shouted, "whose canonized bones we saw hearsed in death and inured under the frowning battlements of Sumter, we shall never see again while the world standeth. Stop fighting for a dead past," Douglas urged his auditors, "and instead fight for the living present." Here flowed a set of rebirth metaphors, flaming, bloody, and much bolder than the succinct, if beautiful, suggestion in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Mission of the War stood as Douglas's radical abolitionist Gettysburg Address, a rhetorical sword into the Confederacy's heart, and a statement of the war's meaning as ancient as the Old Testament. Above all, it was Douglas's vision of the new founding of an American republic. Douglas ultimately appropriated a common American language to capture the meaning of the war. "We have heard much in other days of manifest destiny. I don't go all the lengths to which such theories are pressed, but I do believe that it is the manifest destiny of this war to unify and reorganize the institutions of this country, and that herein is the secret of the strength, the fortitude, the persistent energy, in a word, the sacred significance of this war." In a line that challenges us still in our moral imagination, Douglas said that without the destruction of slavery, the world might view the Civil War as only little better than a gigantic enterprise for shedding human blood. Not only had the war delivered the nation a broken constitution requiring a legal refounding, but history itself had been broken and had to be made anew. Douglas volunteered to lead a generation of new founders. "Events are mightier than our rulers," Douglas asserted, "and divine forces had decided the mission of the war. The people had to line up, sacrifice, send forth their sons, and perform the sacred duty of holy war." Douglas left his rapt audiences that winter of 1864 with a clear, if harsh, message. "I end where I began. No war, but an abolition war. No peace, but an abolition peace. Liberty for all, chains for none. The black man a soldier in war, a laborer in peace, a voter at the South as well as at the North. America his permanent home, and all Americans his fellow countrymen." In a finale that anticipates Martin Luther King Jr.'s "I Have a Dream" speech a century later, Douglas invoked Isaiah once again. "Such, fellow citizens, is my idea of the mission of the war. If accomplished, our glory as a nation will be complete. Our peace will flow like a river, and our foundations will be the everlasting rocks." Thousands heard Douglas deliver this speech. Those drawn into his voice and his story were present at the new creation. Dreams, by definition, though, are always unfinished. This was certainly the case for Douglas's blood-soaked vision of 1864. Imagining a new, reinvented country brought one challenge, but the war remained a very personal affair for Douglas and his family. In the fall of 1863, Rosetta Douglas gave up on her faltering teaching career and her formal education and took a husband. On Christmas Eve in Rochester, she married Nathan Sprague, a handsome former fugitive slave from Maryland who had been working as a gardener at the Douglas home. Rosetta very much resembled her mother, including her darker skin. Although unlike her mother and very much modeling her father, she seemed to embrace having her photograph taken, especially in elegant earrings. Sprague was lighter and, in family lore, may have been descended from a Maryland governor, Samuel Sprigg. Over the next 11 years, Rosetta and Nathan would have 5 daughters and 1 son. In this tempestuous marriage, Sprague never developed a gainful career and eventually caused financial and legal troubles for his father-in-law. Steadiness and talent were not his forte. Like her mother, though, Rosetta seems to have almost always stood by her husband. Douglas recruited Sprague into the 54th Massachusetts before the wedding. And after living with Rosetta in the Douglas house on the hill on South Street in the winter months, he joined the regiment in the spring of 1864. After recovery from his wounds, Lewis Douglas tried to rejoin his regiment, but was discharged formally on February 29, 1864. By that summer, Lewis traveled on army transports back to South Carolina.